Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best book ever written by a weirdo author. Is that how we want to position this theme?
I guess.
It's kind of weird. To help me are two weirdos. Two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe. I said that right.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, I have a real weirdo for you this week. I have Orson Scott Card, and I think that you should read Ender's Game.
My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, not a weirdo. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book by a weirdo, let's go through the looking glass and down the rabbit hole into the nonsensical world of Lewis Carroll, also known as Charles Dodgson. I'm doing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
See, now I feel like this is unfair because I happen to know that Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is Nick's wife's favorite book.
No way.
How is that unfair?
This is bullshit.
You shut your mouth, Joe. This is the worst news. As we know, Nick tends to fail books that he has read or he knows. So my goodness gracious, I'm doomed.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Nick, I'm also concerned that you know things about Ender's Game. Have you read Ender's Game?
I have not.
Have you seen the 2013 film starring Ben Kingsley and Harrison Ford?
I think I tried to watch like the first, like, I think the first 10 minutes.
Oh, Nick, I think that movie's outstanding. So I think you and I might be on different pages today.
Wow. There's no way it's outstanding.
Oh, my most vivid memory of that movie is not remembering it. So there was a, when I lived in Milwaukee, there was a bargain movie theater way down south, like almost out of Milwaukee. Maybe you guys are familiar with it. The kind of place that like has like third run movies for $2. And being a poor graduate student, I went there a lot, even though it probably cost as much in gas to get there as a normal ticket would have been. Anyway, the point is I went to see Ender's Game there, and I remember more the strange people who were in the theater and the way the theater smelled more than what happened in the movie. That's my memory of that movie.
Did it smell because of the theater, or did it smell because of the people in the theater?
I didn't go sniff the people to see if they were the source of it. But I couldn't, so I can neither confirm nor deny.
I'd like to interject your nonsense.
I
okay.
wish you would.
Okay. I'd like to kick off this episode, since Lewis Carroll's in play and this is about weird things. Well, specifically authors, but I'm just going to build upon that for a second. All right. I don't know if you guys are familiar. Joe, I don't know if you've heard this story before, but I guess it really doesn't matter because I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to our audience here.
Loyal leadheads.
Thank you for really walking us through that our opinions don't matter. It's only the audience. Anyway, as you were saying.
So, leadheads, if you are ever in New York and you have any interest in Lewis Carroll, there is a theater company in Brooklyn, and you can just look up Then She Fell. And I don't know how to explain this, but it's the weirdest experience, certainly the weirdest theater experience, but maybe the weirdest live entertainment I've ever seen. It's basically an interactive play through a house in Brooklyn where you learn about Lewis Carroll's life story told by a cast of extremely talented people. There's only 15 people in the audience, and you are guided by a series of cast members through the house to tell you different parts of his life. And so just to give you one example, okay, so you're like in a room and there's like a mirror, and you're in this room and you're asked to like look around the room for clues, and you do that, and then like you go through the house and you learn more about the, you know, you finish the experience, whatever. Oh, maybe I'm ruining this. This is actually an unavoidable spoiler.
Nick, we have three rules this week, as you know. Rule number one, unavoidable
Joe?
Spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything? It's the only thing. Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Those are, of course, as our Legion to Litheads know, the three rules.
I really like how you incorporated the full rule two. The full text of rule two is includes Joe at the end.
Do you think Joe's going to start referring to himself in the third person?
I hope he does, like The Rock. Hey, Nick, you were telling us something with an unavoidable spoiler, so I'm
yeah,
really
so like
curious.
At the beginning of the play, you know, you were like, there's a huge mirror in the room, and then you get to the end of the play, and it's a double-sided mirror, and like the other people in the audience were like looking at you the whole time when you were searching through this room.
That's
it's like
freaky.
It's this series of like extremely bizarre situations, but you like learn about Lewis Carroll, and it's all through like the lens of like Alice in Wonderland. So like there's like the Mad Hatter and all this kind of stuff. It's so
I was going to
cool.
ask, is there a tea party? Do you sit down for tea at some point?
Obviously there's tea.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Is there a potion that you drink to make you bigger? Are you bigger?
Are you how big were you when you started? Fantastical rules of this world.
Yes. It defines all space and time.
Nick, I have so many questions. This is fascinating and a huge new facet of this this podcast. I think we can just recap our theater experiences. So here's my question. Theater, weird theater in New York tends to fall into one of two categories. Either it's weird and artsy and for the extremely artsy crowd, or it's weird and touristy for tourists.
So not be touristy.
So was it artsy? Was it like really high art?
Yeah. You could just imagine, just close your eyes and imagine several members of your everyone's own family, uncles, fathers that would all hate this.
I feel like a two-way mirror could be at the end of a haunted house. Like, is it spooky? Is it scary?
Oh, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it sounds scary.
That's it. It's like in the middle of a neighborhood too. And then you like just walk out with these 15 people, like everything is normal and it's not.
Yeah. It's like the experience of like going to a matinee movie and like leaving and it's daytime outside and it's this like disorienting thing, like where you're back in the real world.
God, I miss matinees.
Don't you just miss everything?
guys, we already went over the show rules. Thank you, Joe.
No problem, guys.
So I think we could just jump right into the plots, our 30 second plots here. Joe, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I would love to go first. Nick, Ender's Game is a sci-fi staple that I would say is unputdownable. It's about a six-year-old boy. It's about a six-year-old boy genius selected by his government to go through intensive training to become a commander that saves the world. Upon publication in 1985, it won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards, the first science fiction novel to ever do so. The Hugo and Nebula Awards are pretty elite awards in the science fiction community. Orson Scott Card would win them both again the next year with his sequel, Speaker for the Dead.
Wow. Next year?
The next year, he published
Ender's
Game.
Did he have them both like queued up, or was it?
So, fun fact.
wait, you're doing fun facts now? What is this?
You asked the question.
I did. You know, I did. It was a leading question, Your Honor. Go ahead.
He actually wrote Speaker for the Dead first, and he really liked the world of it, but he felt like it needed more backstory. So he wrote Ender's Game to establish the world for Speaker of the Dead as a prequel. Published Ender's Game first. Wildly successful. It was the first novel that he ever published, won both awards. Published Speaker for the Dead literally the next year, won both awards again. Wildly successful.
Ian, it's your turn.
Okay. When Alice falls asleep under a tree, her dreams take her chasing a white rabbit underground and into a world of fantastic nonsense, illogic, and surreality. She plays croquet with flamingos. She eats and drinks magical potions. She faces off with the Queen of Hearts. Why am I explaining this plot? It's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Everyone knows this story.
Next band of the house.
Is there more to the story than we know?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, obviously, like otherwise I'm done. Like that's it. I've made my case. I rest my case. No, there's a lot of fun stuff. Both about
the
author.
We need to set
some
ground rules because one, I don't really understand why we picked this theme other than just talking about weird authors. And I'm fine with that. But two, how do we find a winner?
Yeah.
Well, I think Nick, the tradition, the convention of this show has been for you to decide the winner based on just your whim, whatever the heck you're feeling in the moment. So I'm not sure why we would set ground rules, because you know you're just going to choose based on how you feel at the very given moment.
Yeah. Do we want to pretend like we should establish some ground rules?
Yes, 100%. Let's pretend.
Sure. I think let's establish the fiction of the show. Cool. Yes.
So I'm thinking, like, if whoever gets the weirdest fact wins.
Oh, God. See, now I have a problem. I would like to object to this rule, because my writer is not so
that is
much.
You're right.
He's not so much a weirdo as he is like a racist and homophobe and normal person. So I mean, weird, sure. Like, sure, he's weird, but more like he's really a dick.
Oh, okay. So, Ian, would you like to retort? Was Lewis Carroll a total racist as well?
No.
We are competing.
No, I don't have racism to marshal, nor homophobia, as far as I know. I mean, like, he did live in the 1800s, and it was the Victorian era, so everything was
crazy.
So
he was probably a racist.
So he was probably homophobe.
We don't have the kind of concrete evidence we might have with Orson Scott Card for
Who is still alive and saying inflammatory things to this day.
Oh, no.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. He's toned it down quite a bit. He's really cooled it. But I have a list of like homophobic comments and publications that he had, like going straight up through like 2015.
Are we going to play a game? Did Orson Scott Card say it, or was it a YouTube comment?
I recently started tagging authors in some of our social media posts. Joe, do I have the green light on this one to start tagging, or?
Yes. Oh,
yeah. Hey, go for it. Go for it. I think a lawsuit would only increase the notoriety of our podcast.
Yeah.
No such thing as bad publicity.
Those fake sponsors haven't come through yet. So we really got to start bringing up Audible more often. I miss talking about them. Have you guys heard any good Audible books lately?
So,
no.
Well, here's the thing. I want to actually recommend, I think the audiobook for Ender's Game is really good, but I wouldn't really recommend getting it on Audible, because I don't think you should give Orson Scott Card your money. I think you should pirate it on YouTube. There are several good fan recordings.
You know, this is admissible in a court of law. So
yeah. Also,
you just did go on the record. Joe.
Also, this is probably a good time to announce that we're going to start charging for this podcast.
Don't you dare pirate this.
So please don't pirate this. $10 an episode. We think it's fair.
Very fair.
I guess let's get the racism out of the way. Joe?
All right.
Take it away.
So I don't want to bury the lead here. He is a racist, but he's more homophobic than he is racist, right? Like
Okay, I'm concerned how you phrased that. Just is that a good thing?
No, but I feel like I might have misrepresented him in my early comments, right? Like I led with racist, but he's really like the headline is homophobe. The subtext is maybe racist.
Okay. Still not sure why that is a good thing. So keep going.
So
listen, you got to take a cue from me. When I brought an actual Nazi author, I waited until like minute 30 to talk about the Nazism. You gotta build it up. So it's like, it's an amazing, let me tell you the great story. Oh, by the way, he's a racist and a homophobe, whatever, but the story.
Ian wasn't even going to bring that up. We coerced it out of him.
So we bring a lot of books, right? And Ian, I don't know if you feel like this.
Well, exactly two a week.
Well,
but
it's like
stacking up, right? We're on what, episode 360 at this point?
Yeah, 362.
Right. That's millions of books.
Yeah.
Nobody can do that math.
Yeah, that's why you're English teachers.
But Nick, so like I bring a book every week, and every book I bring, I genuinely really like, right? There's a lot of books I bring that I love. There's a lot of books that I bring that I think are really interesting. But the concept of the show is that we are telling you about books that you should read. Sometimes, Nick, I'm going to confess here, I bring books that I don't really think you would enjoy that much.
Yes.
That's fair.
Like for example, when I talked about Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, I think it was a really cool book, a really interesting book. I don't really think you should read that book, Nick. However,
you're not smart enough, is what he's saying.
however,
Nick, I already read it.
How was it?
No, I didn't read it. I'm just
kidding. Did the animals do it? However, Nick, I do think you should read Ender's Game. I think everybody should read Ender's Game. My experience reading this is I picked it up just on a whim. I was probably 30 years old at the time. It was actually probably shortly before the movie came out. I might have read it because the movie was coming out. And it was a book that I read incredibly quickly. I couldn't put it down. And it was just I guess a page turner is what we would call it. Unputdownable is what we might call it. Nick, this is not just a really engrossing book, not just a book that you can't put down, but it's just like a nice book that makes you feel things. It makes you feel happy and it makes you feel sad. And there's like tough decisions that are made. And it's very philosophical in the decisions and the tactics and the outcomes. Nick, I think you would genuinely, genuinely, genuinely love reading this book.
Let's stop a second. Joe, were you lying? Were you lying all those times that those other books were in here? And
it's
I
hard
guess
to
a follow
move
up
on.
If you,
yeah,
if
I feel
if
like
I can.
I've been betrayed.
How dare
yeah.
you?
I
listen.
I
there's like, there's a social contract on this show.
Well, the challenge is litheads. Let me speak to the litheads directly.
Oh, now you're speaking to the litheads. My goodness,
litheads. Every week, Ian and I bring a book, and sometimes we bring a book that we have never read before for that week. So we'll have a theme coming up and we'll purposely pick out a new book for us to read so that we could talk about it that week. And the thing is sometimes that book's amazing. And sometimes it's, I don't want to say a dud, but it's challenging, right? Sometimes that book is challenging. But the problem is, you guys remember high school English. The problem is we've just read the one book for that week. So like it or not,
it out,
that's
Joe.
The book we're talking about.
Let it out. I don't know what any of this has to do with Weirdos authors. So can we get back to the content?
Yeah, let's talk about Orson Scott Card just for
okay.
a second.
Because I want to know about how weird he was, Joe.
Well, I feel like the first thing I'm going to say you're not going to think is weird.
Ian, get your victory speech ready.
So Orson Scott Card is, he's a Mormon. He's a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. He
is weird.
Yeah,
that's who we're alienating this week then.
Yay, we found them.
The state of Utah and young men, two by two, all over the day, all over the world. He, was born in Utah. He did his mission in Brazil. He claims that Brigham Young is his great-great-grandfather. By the way, Brigham Young might actually be his great-great-grandfather, but I am a little bit skeptical.
Isn't that something that'd be pretty easy to prove? Or great-great-grand? Yeah. That's not
well,
that
Well, remember, Brigham had quite a few of these spouses.
It's true.
Was I told that earlier? I didn't know.
No,
I have
this
to
is just like
that.
A thing you know about him. He
yeah,
was one
like
of those who practiced
card.
Bigamy.
Oh, okay.
Right. Brigham Young. Brigham.
Brigamy.
Polygamy. Polygamy Young. Sorry. This is dreadful.
It's a really good episode so far.
You shouldn't mock these people.
That
really?
Feels like that feels like Yosemite Sam's like enemy. Like Brigham Young.
That's really stupid.
And yet you're laughing at it. Who's laughing now? You.
One of the things that you are not going to like about Orson Scott Card is he has
theme.
A really punchable face.
Was that really in your notes?
Yeah. Yeah, it's bullet point
listen,
seven.
Joe goes
bullet
all
point
in
seven,
on this
punchable face.
Literally.
Gotta write that down.
1 second. I will read my bullet point exactly. He is really, comma, really punchable. And I say this because in the extensive research that I do for these episodes every week, I watched
Greg.
An hour and a half long interview with him and Ben Shapiro. Is that how you say his name?
Yes, that
yeah,
is.
Sure.
And the entire time they were on split screen, just on Ben Shapiro's YouTube channel. And I kept looking forth between the two of them, trying to decide who was more punchable.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
And did you come to a conclusion?
I think it's Orson Scott Card. And I think the main problem is the entire time he was talking, he has like this like the corner of it. So look at that picture. Do you see how the corner of his mouth like kind of curls? Like he just looks like he's like smirking at a joke that he just told.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's how he looks all the time. Like just all the time. Every time he would answer a question, like he just has that like smug, self-satisfied look on his face. And it really does come across as punchable.
Solid literary criticism there.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Joe. That applies to both the theme and the plot of the book. Joe, you've said he's punchable. You said he's racist. These are not weird things. They are undesirable things. Undesirable characteristics. Do you have anything weird? Otherwise, let's get into the book.
I have a quote for you from 1990 in an article that he wrote. He says, "Laws against homosexual behavior should remain on the books. They should not be indiscriminately enforced against anyone who happens to be caught, but should be used when necessary to send a clear message to those who flagrantly violate society's regulation of sexual behavior. They cannot be permitted to remain as acceptable, equal citizens within society."
Oh, we should have saved that for the end. The end quote.
Oh, I've got more where that Jesus. Came from.
Is he doing like a political thing? Maybe it's like satire. Maybe he's like trolling everybody and he's actually like a good guy.
I've got another quote from 1990. "If the church has no authority to tell its members that they may not engage in homosexual practices, then it has no authority at all. And if we accept the argument of the hypocrites of homosexuality that their sin is not a sin, we've destroyed ourselves."
He's really committed to this irony. This
And the thing is like, I have this list of quotes from him and they start in about 1990. He published Ender's Game in 1985. And the homophobic quotes start in 1990 as he's writing for various LDS publications for the most part. The problem is like, I think, okay, well, it's a thing he said in 1990. The world was different. Like, things have changed somewhat since then, right? Or substantially in a lot of ways. Okay. Maybe he's seen the error of his ways. I'm going to give you a quote from 2014.
I'm sure we've all changed a lot over, 30 years. That's a long time. Right?
I just turned 30 the other day, so I can't speak to this.
I regret a lot of things I said when I was 1 year old. I sounded like an idiot back then.
All right. I got one more quote for you. Okay. And then it'll be the last one.
Hey, Joe, can I stop you?
Yep.
I'm beginning to see. At first, I didn't see why you selected him. It's a weird. And now I'm getting it. I'm starting to see that actually all of this is pretty weird.
It's pretty weird.
I didn't know he was going to be so outspoken.
He's very outspoken. And actually,
which is what makes it weird.
I think Orson Scott Card, he was a victim of very poor timing in a lot of ways, right? He said indefensible things pretty much the entire time he's been famous. But when the Ender's Game movie was in production, it was 2012, 2013, Barack Obama's entering his second term in office. And of course, gay marriage is becoming legal nationwide at that point. Right.
Yes.
Orson Scott Card was getting canceled at that time. People dug up quotes that
before we even had this kind of terminology.
Yeah. Before we even really, I think canceled? For sure, before we called it canceled culture. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Orson Scott Card is this movie's coming out and all of a sudden these things that he wrote in 1990 surfaced and he started being asked about them in interviews and he just didn't back down. So he has these quotes from 2012, from 2013, as this movie's coming out where he continues to say, homophobic, bigoted, small things. Last one I've got for you. He says, "Legalizing gay marriage is not about making it possible for gay people to become couples. It's about giving the left the power to enforce anti-religious views on our children. Once they legalize gay marriage, it will be the bludgeon that they use to make sure that it becomes illegal to teach traditional values in the schools."
Was he just homophobic? Is that really where he planted his flag?
Okay, so most of his public outcry is homophobic.
That's really weird.
When a lot of his fans found this out, like when this kind of came to light, because of course people had been Orson Scott Card fans for, 30 years at the time that these comments kind of came to light or became like publicly known. And I think a lot of fans were really crushed and really heartbroken. And I think one of the surprising things about it is these comments, if you are familiar with Orson Scott Card's work, especially his early work, which is by far his most acclaimed work, they really come out of left field. Because when you read Ender's Game, when you read Speaker for the Dead, when you read his early novels, not only like are these themes not inside of it, like not only are these like is this idea of like this bigotry, is that that's not inside it, but they really are open-minded and empathetic and inclusive. And it seems like it seems like in so many ways we have a Jekyll and Hyde situation where this the writer seems totally divorced from the author, or the novel seems totally divorced from the creator in these places. And I think it's for a lot of fans, it was this really tough thing to reconcile.
And that might be more difficult, especially since he's still alive. Like a lot of times the controversial stuff that we've talked about this on the Fun Robots episode, you know, divorcing the art from the artist. I think it's easier to have that conversation and to make that move, that intellectual move of, okay, I'm just going to focus on the art when the author is dead, when the author isn't still like popping up in the news and saying stuff.
Yeah, insane inflammatory right. things.
When he's alive and when you know, like, oh, no, Orson, you said another thing I disagree with. Stop it. Oh, you did this, again. What is this?
This article calls J.K. Rowling the female Orson Scott Card. Ooh. That's
well,
good
but I mean, that's
journalism.
That's actually another pretty good example. You know, J.K. Yeah, Rowling absolutely. Comes under a lot of flack for kind of this revisionism that she does to the Harry Potter series when she comes out and says, oh, this character was black, or this character was trans, or this character was gay all along, right? And it seems like almost this inclusionary revisionism that, I don't know. I guess I don't know where I'm going with that.
Joe, I'm not sure if you've been keeping up on the whole J.K. Rowling thing. I don't believe she has, and I don't believe she would come out and say this character was trans.
Really? Oh, no, I don't think I knew that.
Yes, she is outspoken. I shouldn't say it like that. She is deliberately quiet on trans issues.
Interesting.
And her most recent novel involves a cisgender man dressing up as a woman and killing people.
Wow.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Tell me about Ender's Game.
Yeah. So let's talk about Ender's Game.
Having dug a massive hole for your author. Yeah.
Boy.
Let his taut science fiction prose lever him out of it.
Hey, Ian, can I give you some just advice for when it's your turn? You
should please
pitch the book first.
Well, I'm planning on it.
It's going to be a tough pitch, Joe. Let's go.
All right. So, Nick, Ender's Game, quick overview of the book. It follows a 6-year-old boy.
A piece of shit racist.
No, it follows a wonderful, empathetic young boy who is taken from his family on Earth to an orbital military academy. And there, it is his entire life is engineered for him to become a soldier in an extraterrestrial war. But not just a soldier, a commander in the war. This military academy essentially conscripts. Let's say conscripts. They conscript child geniuses and raise them in an environment that will turn out perfect military commanders, because the world is under attack from a species of aliens from light years away called the Buggers. There's been an attack before.
Were they bugs? Were they bugs or English?
They're kind of like, you ever see the Zerg in StarCraft? Nick, did you ever play StarCraft?
Nope.
Ian? Did you ever see Starship Troopers?
There you go.
Have you ever seen stars? Why? What's the relevance here?
So they're kind of like that. That's how they're depicted. They're just kind of these like insectoids is maybe what we would call them.
Okay, so they are bugs.
Yeah, they're bug-ish.
Then I have a question. Now, was this species called buggers, or was this just like our derogatory term for them?
It is like just it's just the derogatory term for them. The species is
that seems very is called, that seems right. We would come up with some sort of terrible name if we were invaded.
The bugs are coming, but the big problem is they have come before. They've been there before. They attacked Earth before, and Earth barely survived. It was only through the genius of a military commander that the species of humanity got out of it, right? Now they think that a second wave is coming. So Ender is conscripted from his family as a 6-year-old, and he's put into this military academy with some of the world's scariest adolescent, like, prodigies. He has to work his way up the pecking order. He has to master these war games that they put that these kids inside of to, like, hone their tactical minds and their military abilities and just, like, their
now is this like
dexterity.
How long does the book take to do that? Does he move up pretty quickly, or is this like an 80s montage where he's just kind of like karate chopping people and like taking a test real quick and then he's like on top right away?
This book really does move quickly through Ender, you know, being at school, being monitored by the military, being taken from his family, going to this academy, working his way up. Like, every chapter has like these big milestones in it. So it does move, not montage quick, but pretty freaking quick.
Okay. How long is this book?
Don't know.
If you don't know, just guess.
Yeah, 200 pages, 250 pages, tops.
Great.
Yep.
Okay, so that's pretty digestible.
Yeah, it is. It's a quick read. It's a breezy read.
Is this a fun read?
Is it a good read?
Would you use the words quote unquote fun or quote unquote good read together?
I would use the words fun.
Okay.
I would use the words engrossing, and I would use the words ultimately, I think, a mind blowing read. This is one of those books.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. We went 0-60 fast there.
Yeah.
This is one of those books that I read it again, like I said, maybe 5 years ago, I read it for the first time. And I think about this book all the time still, like just all the time.
So Joe, can I just, I've never read this book, but can I just guess the plot?
Go for it.
Okay. So, All right. So he's like kind of like the Superman. He's got like the Jesus vibe going on, right? Like he's like going to save humanity.
Sure.
Do they know he's going to save humanity, or is that how the book ends? So
they go ahead.
So he's like raised up to become some like high performing person, but then he figures out a way to defeat the enemy. Is that pretty much what the plot is?
So he's raised up to become some sort of high performing person, and he is seen as like a bit of a savior. But he's also put into this military academy with a ton of kids who are just as smart and just as capable as he is. So it's never this foregone conclusion. Like, it's incredibly competitive. There's like competitions between the boys. They're put into teams and pitted against each other. The academy leaders, it's always this, it's this interesting thing going on in the book, because the academy leaders, it is their job to raise the person and train the person who will save humanity. But that also means making Ender's life kind of terrible throughout this book. For example, they frequently isolate him from his peers. They frequently put him against like overwhelming odds in these battles, because the battle that they're going to ultimately fight here is against overwhelming odds. They want him to hone his resourcefulness. They want him to hone his like outsiderness in a lot of ways. And they are pretty terrible to Ender throughout this. And like the people pulling the strings in Ender's life, stuff that Ender sees is just happenstance or just circumstance, and these situations that he finds himself in is really intentionally orchestrated by the people at the academy in order to make him like the perfect strategic genius military commander killing machine.
So Joe, how does he rise up? How does he become unique?
Well,
what's he do to stand out?
Nick,
is this a spoiler?
Okay, so I've full disclosure, I've read this book, and I will say Joe is doing a great job of avoiding spoilers. So just be warned, Nick.
So we don't have to get into the why, right? What is Ender's Game? Would that answering that ruin something? I bet it would.
No, I don't think so.
No, so the games. The games that they play are inside of the military academy, there's essentially like a war games room that they go into. And it's this like zero gravity orb on this spaceship, on the space station that they train in. And they are pitted of army against army, or I guess like squadron against squadron, with different objectives. When we talk about Ender's Game, we could talk about like these little games, but ultimately like Ender's Game is like this long game that he plays to kind of get to the top of the pecking order with his fellow cadets. And ultimately the game that he plays against the buggers.
Like, is this a novel that you could say, ignore the author, read the book?
100%. This is a book that I'm not going to say for its immediate sequels, because I've read a handful of them, and I think Ender's Game is unimpeachably the best of them.
Okay.
But I would say, read Ender's Game. Know nothing about Orson Scott Card. That's totally fine, right? Read Ender's Game. It's an outstanding read. That, you know, for all of his bigotry and homophobia, right, that he has in his personal life, that is not in Ender's Game. Ender's Game is an empathetic, it is like a loving, it is a textured and nuanced and really intelligent novel. And just the main thing I like about it, it's a blast to read. Absolutely a blast.
Hey, what do you think is the best book ever written by Cormac McCarthy?
I think it's his book, his 1985 epic novel, Blood Meridian or The Evening Redness in the West. But I don't think I'm up to bringing that book, so I'm going to bring what I think is his second best book, perhaps, All the Pretty Horses.
Is Blood Meridian about beautiful sunrises and sunsets?
Nick, I don't know how to say this. The Redness in the West is less a redness of...
like the beautiful sunset.
It's more like blood splatters.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh my.
Sorry.
Oh. Well, that sounds like a downer. Let's bring something more positive.
I'm bringing a book about a big old horsey.
Oh, cool.
And maybe there may be, I can't guarantee this, but there may be tacos.
And Joe, are you going to bring a really fun, upbeat book to discuss next week?
I'm going to bring not a very happy book at all. I'm going to bring the post-apocalyptic, horrifying book, Road. The Road by Cormac McCarthy. It's good.
All right. Join us next week for Cormac Week, where we discuss a book about really big horses and a really big downer. Ian, take us down your rabbit hole.
Don't say it like that. That's dreadful. Okay. Hey, folks, listen, this is super daunting because knowing that Nick is, by the transitive property, a Alice in Wonderland super fan, I feel like I'm on notice here. But
yeah,
I have some fun facts about the book. And I do want to talk about the book because... even though everyone knows this book, there are some things I think are worth mentioning about it that maybe aren't so well known. This guy, this man, Charles Dodgson, for the uninformed listener, and that's very few of you, litheads, I know how erudite all of you are. When I say Charles Dodgson, that's
you
the
can
guy
just
that
addressed me.
Nick, as a stand-in for our most erudite listeners.
Yo.
That's funny, that's how they talk.
Yep.
So this guy wrote this novel under a pen name, Lewis Carroll. And that's how everyone knows the author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. His real name was Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, but there are too many just sounds in that name. So he went by Lewis Carroll. Yeah. I'm going to be referring to him by his real name because I'm going to be talking about him, not only as an author.
Just Lewis Carroll. Agree. Yeah.
Are you serious? Yeah, oh my God. I got to do a find and replace in this whole document.
Yep. Control F.
Nobody cares.
Control F.
Lewis Carroll. There are fewer J sounds in Lewis Carroll for sure. So Lewis Carroll suffered from a little side note on that. I never do any of my research in Wikipedia.
What's his real name again?
Oh boy.
No, seriously, just one more time.
Charles
Ludwig Lutwidge Dodgson.
Is it
not Ludwig?
Ludwig?
Lutwidge.
No, not this is an important point when I get to talking about him. So don't talk about that yet. We'll get to that. Don't worry.
How can we not talk about it yet?
Okay, fine. This is a family name. It's spelled L U T W I D G E. Lutwidge. Okay. He's named, I guess the middle name comes from his mother's side. His uncle was named Skeffington Lutwidge.
Ooh, that's a good name.
That is
a punchable name. Jesus. Funny enough, what did you
I
just
have
say?
A bullet point about
Skeffington.
Skeffington Lutwidge. It sounds like that's the kind of thing you would name a child you didn't particularly like.
Yeah. Like Uncle Skeffy. What do you think they're called? Yeah. this kid looks punchable. Skeffington it is.
So his full name was Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, but I will be referring to him as Lewis Carroll because it's easier to say. Okay, so this dude, Lewis Carroll, suffered from migraines and perhaps he had epilepsy. This is one of the things that historians kind of are fascinated with, is diagnosing people from the old times before like we could actually diagnose them. Diagnosing based on their accounts of their experiences. So there are a lot of medieval mystics. Like
it sounds medieval very European. Scientific, Ian.
No, it's not. This is the point. Like this is just historical speculation. Like they say, like, oh, I'm gonna read these prophecies by medieval mystics who had visions, and I'm gonna say, oh, look, they saw a bunch of lights in the sky, and that's a symptom of this kind of grand mal seizures, and so we're gonna say they had epilepsy.
Yeah, I mean, this is nonsense. Like, I mean, like every time I hear something like this, I think, oh, shut the fuck up. Like you don't know. Like, you're just making things up.
Maybe he had epilepsy. But the cool thing about this is it's possible that some of these sort of experiences in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland are based on sort of his fluctuating perception as he underwent epileptic and migraine events. So there's actually a kind of subtype of epilepsy, which involves altered perception. So things will seem super large and then all of a sudden super small and then super large again.
Interesting, yeah.
And this has been named after Lewis Carroll because like people are like, oh, hey, he may have had epilepsy. And also he describes Alice fluctuating in size. So.
Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. Alex. The sequel.
Here's another fun fact. This book is commonly referred to as Alice in Wonderland. But the title of the book is Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And this dates back to his initial title, which was Alice's Adventures Underground. But then he quickly realized that's a sort of a boring name, so he went with Wonderland instead.
That's got to be a little frustrating to write a book and like everybody gets the name wrong.
All the time.
Right. All the time.
Like, that's the brand.
The brand is an inaccurate title.
Yeah. I will say that Wonderland is a pretty, like, it's evocative. Like, when you hear Alice in Wonderland, like, it's, your imagination is firing.
I will say that Wonderland always sounds a lot more positive than the realm that she goes to actually is. Like, the place she goes is pretty, like,
spooky.
Ridiculous out there. Yeah, in like a dark way, kind of.
Yeah.
Like,
are we going to talk about drugs? Are we going to talk about the drugs? Or
we're going to talk about drugs. Yeah, don't worry. Nice. I got some more fun facts, though. Okay.
Yep.
Just hang on, Nick. Here's another fun fact. Okay. Listen to this. Queen Victoria, famous for being the queen during the Victorian era, loved this book so much that she asked, and this is an apocryphal story, but it might be true. So I'm going with it. She loved it so much, she asked Lewis Carroll to dedicate a book to her. And so what he did, being just a real scamp, is part when he wasn't writing books about Alex in Wonderland, he was writing mathematical treatises. And so what he did was he wrote a mathematical treatise and dedicated that to her.
Amazing.
And what guts, right? To prank the queen. You're pranking the Queen of England. Good, solid move.
It's bold.
Probably the strangest fun fact that I would bring to your attention. I'm sure all of you saw Tim Burton's masterful 2010 adaptation starring Jonathan Depp and some other people, Christopher Lee as the Jabberwocky.
Probably Tim Burton's wife is in it.
Yes. So this movie, 2010, became the fifth highest grossing movie of all time.
Wow.
Which is so confusing because it was thoroughly mediocre.
Yeah, it was terrible. I think of Orson Scott Card getting farther and farther up his ass as his career went on. And I think Tim Burton is definitely in that category as well. And same with Johnny Depp.
All it takes. Well, I'm not going to say mean things about Johnny Depp because he's in the middle of a difficult legal battle.
But Tim Burton, I don't want to add to his.
I know he's a longtime listener to the show, and I don't want to add to his stress.
So good for you. That is good. That isn't very nice of you. Very mature.
Yeah, I just, you know, taking care of my bro.
Ian.
Hey, yeah.
Tell me about this weirdo. Give me like the greatest hits.
Oh, boy.
Give me the list.
He had a great grandfather who was a bishop, and that good for him, I guess. So he became, Lewis Carroll became a deacon in the Church of England, and he was like getting set to become a minister. He's getting set to be ordained. But for reasons we don't know, we don't understand, he withdrew from that at the last minute. And so historians, there are a lot of mysteries about Lewis Carroll's life. One of them is, why did he kind of pull out from being ordained as a minister in the Church of England? And they don't really know. Some people say that he really liked going to the theater. And one of the things you couldn't do if you were a minister was go to the theater.
Plus, he married his cousin.
No, did he? I didn't know that.
Wait, what?
I don't think I knew that. Interesting.
I didn't.
Isn't that like his big thing?
That's Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh yeah, I did. Yes, he did. First cousin. Man, it was a different time.
First cousin. Wow.
Yeah. They didn't know about consanguinity, or maybe they did and didn't care.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, like they knew.
Oh boy.
But England's a small place though. Like it's just a little island.
Yeah, he did. He did marry his first cousin. So that's a thing. He was also an inventor.
Oh, so, that's fun. Was it steampunky? Yeah, like, was it like steam powered stuff? Like,
no,
was it
kind of like, okay, reading about his inventions, researching his inventions. He was obviously like, he had good inventions. And I think he is legitimately, he came up with enough stuff that we can legitimately call him an inventor. But you know, like there's inventors who come up with like the rocket ship or a television.
Yep.
And then there's inventors who are like, I have invented a great new way to fluff the pillows on my bed.
Sure.
So that they will not be stinky. Like some of his stuff is good. He invented a game, which is like an early version of Scrabble, a prototype for the game Scrabble.
Fun.
He came up with different rules for tennis.
Oh.
He did like have some interesting and alternative ways to vote in Parliament.
Hey, can I just say, Ian, that Lewis Carroll or Charles Lutwidge Dodson, he sounds like kind of lovely. Like he really sounds like this, like,
yeah, he doesn't sound weird at all.
No, he doesn't sound, he sounds charming. Like he sounds like he'd be a black, like he sounds quirky. Like he'd be fun to have at a party.
Are you weaving a story? Because like everything that you said was lovely. And the only thing that I said was that he married his first cousin. So I feel like, are you doing the right digging here?
Oh, are you setting this up to knock us down, Ian? Like is the devastating stuff coming?
Well, there's one Ooh. Question.
Was
a historical
he a, was
question.
Was he a Nazi?
He was not. Okay. I don't know if I could handle two accidental Nazis. So, like a lot of people, in this time, Lewis Carroll believed that children were like, yeah, exactly. Children were innocent and like kind of like pure.
Yeah.
Grown-ups, you couldn't say like grown-ups are good. Looking at the world around you, knowing no one in their right mind can say grown-ups are like good people.
Yeah, there's no evidence to support that. He's got a real Michael Jackson thing going on.
Was he the original Michael Jackson?
So I came into this thinking, okay, it's kind of like the reverse of the Nazi one. I came into this thinking, okay, this guy was a perv, basically.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'm actually kind of think maybe there's more evidence for Michael. There's more evidence for Michael Jackson than there is for Lewis Carroll.
Interesting.
So the sense of maybe he was a perv comes from some 1990s historical work, which says, listen, he didn't have any girlfriends and he was only interested in taking photographs of kids.
Mm.
Now,
not a great start.
Nope.
No, it's a concerning start.
Yeah. If you go to the playground and photograph kids, people won't
3,000
like
times.
3,000.
He was known 3, for how many he's taken.
Oh, cool. All of them of children.
So on the surface, like you can marshal evidence to support this reading of his life. But I think, and so I had heard this and I was like, well, dang, I mean, I got to do some art from the artist separating myself here. And this is not my favorite. And then honestly, it kind of maybe cast a cloud on this book for me for a while, but doing the research, it turns out that history work was cherry picking its data somewhat. There is no evidence.
I'm sorry, but in your cursory research, you've concluded that these allegations are all false. I mean, what kind of research did you do?
No, I feel like this is a thing that happens all the time when we talk about like so often we believe a story because it feels so it's too good of a story.
Yep.
Like, I feel like the fact that he is a pedophile is such a sticky story. Like it just grabs you and you think, oh, that has to be true. That makes sense.
Right.
I think that a little bit of digging could go a long way here.
Yeah. So the research I did, Nick, was in fact more extensive than I expected to. I expected to start my research, discover, oh yeah, he said a bunch of really gross and creepy stuff in his diary. And he has a lot of just dreadful concrete evidence that this is the case. But it turns out that this is more like a historian wanted to stir the pot and maybe sell some copies.
Oh, yeah.
And seems to have misrepresented key elements of this argument. So for one thing, the idea that Lewis Carroll didn't have any girlfriends is not true. Like we have historical evidence, both the stuff that this historian had access to, as well as more stuff that's come more recently to light to suggest that, in fact, he was kind of involved in scandal because of his age-appropriate romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. So this kind of key element of the mythos of Lewis Carroll, the creep, it just crumbles right away. And I think the matter of his friendship with kids is more concerning.
Aren't there like some like, because this is a part of that play. It's like it's part of his like story, kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. Isn't there something that like stands out though that it like is kind of like still like irrefutable? I feel like there's something that like has made it linger. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, sure,
you
sure.
Can cut all this. There's
the fact that there's the fact that there's the fact that he dedicates this book to a young woman, an 11-year-old girl.
Mm. I think that was it, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing.
Well, that sounds nice though. He probably wrote it for her. Is it what's his well, relationship?
So it's a story girl. That he and I think a Church of England minister took this girl and her sisters on a boat ride, and he told them this story on the boat ride, and they were like, please write the story down. And so he was like, no, it sucks. But then eventually he was like, okay, fine. And he wrote it down. And so he dedicated it to her. So the story goes, in part because like she was the, and he told it, her name is Alice, and she's the Alice in the story. It's like the thing you do with kids where you like tell them a story about how cool they are and stuff. So like, there is certainly a innocent reading of this, and there's also a much darker reading of it. And so like, that's one thing. Another thing that kind of gives me pause. And it's a hole. It's like a blank hole in this. He was very close to the family to this family, the girls for the Liddell family. And at a certain point, for reasons that are unclear, they abruptly broke off their interaction. They stop being friends.
Yeah, the letter now, stopped one reading at a certain is to point.
What's that?
The correspondence stopped, right? Like when you look at the primary
and one
source,
reading is
stop.
To say, one reading is to say, like, this is he expressed an inappropriate affection, or he expressed interest, or they were like, you're too creepy, and that, I think that's the narrative that this historian who made these claims kind of puts forward. Another reading is that he was kind of at odds with Mr. Liddell over issues of like local church stuff. Mm. And he may have been possibly romantically interested in one of their older daughters. Mm. And that may have been the reason that there's evidence that he was kind of romantically involved with an older daughter in that family. So like... It's one of these things where you can't completely dismiss it.
Mm.
I don't think I believe it, but I don't think I don't believe it at the same time. Like, I'm definitely keeping my options open for for when they find, you know, the Lewis Carroll diaries.
Lawyer here, aren't you?
When we cancel Lewis Carroll.
It's good to go as far as the historical evidence takes us. I'm going to go ahead and say one more thing about this, though. I sure do wish that Lewis Carroll had not made some of the choices he made, like dedicating this book to this girl, this 11-year-old girl. There are things he did which may have been innocent, but in retrospect, seem kind of creepy. Lewis, you should have been better.
Oh, he's like the Biden of writers.
Nice.
It's a really good.
Just a little handsy. It was like, it would have been just fine, but it just like that, just that little.
Like,
weird
don't touch
little
their
thing.
Shoulders so much.
Why did
Joe,
you touch
come on.
That shoulder like that? I would never do that.
Are you sniffing them? It looks like you're sniffing them. Maybe you're not, but just don't. Don't even look
smell
like
smell in a different direction, Joe. Like the rest of us. Man. Anything else, Ian? What's the book about?
I could talk about the book. This is a weird one because
I'd like to. You have 25 seconds to tell me about it.
even less than my plot.
Even less than the plot.
Girl, so I'm gonna talk.
Girl,
I'm gonna say,
girl takes pill. I'll start. I'll help you start out.
Girl takes pill. Girl is fine. And I'll talk. I'm gonna tell you guys a little bit about the printing of this book, because one of the things about this book, one of the things I like about the physical text is that, so there is one of my favorite sort of textual moments in this book is when Alice, who has just grown up to 9 feet tall, cried a whole bunch and then shrunken back down to her normal size and then weighs super small. She ends up falling into the pool of her tears. Mm. So she weeps a whole bunch and then she falls into the pool that she wept. And she meets this mouse while she's swimming around in the pool, and the mouse tells her a story. One might say the mouse tells her a tale, and the tale that the mouse tells is about the mouse's tail. And the telltale is printed on the page like a tail, as in the shape of a tail. Mm. It curves back and forth on the page. It's larger font at the top, like the thick end of a tail, tapering down to tiny font at the bottom. And it's just this moment, especially if you're a kid reading this book, it's just, for me, I vividly remember reading this section and just having my mind blown. Like, I was staring at the page and I couldn't believe what this book was doing. It was a tail about a tail. And it was shaped like a tail. And when I say it like this, it doesn't sound that great. But it's a really interesting kind of innovative or daring visual move that that the text makes. Yeah, it has never been out of print. There has never been a time when it has not been profitable for printers to publish it.
Yeah,
wow. It was
sounds like a nice estate to inherit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my goodness, it must be so.
Yeah.
Lewis Carroll's only hit, like he had Through the Looking Glass, and that was a hit, but it was maybe less so than Alice. He had other books. He had obviously the mathematical stuff, but none of it was as big as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And he actually got to see a stage adaptation of it before he died, which is always, I think, kind of cool, especially in the earlier days of sort of popular media, when an author gets to see their work staged or performed. A few other authors have done this as well, which brings me to today's Hobbit fact, if you guys don't mind. Tolkien died in 1973, so before any of the more well-known films of his work were made. But there was a 12-minute film adaptation of The Hobbit, and I use that word adaptation loosely. A 12-minute adaptation created in 1967. So this is 6 years before Tolkien died. And basically what this is, what this film is a rights scam designed to make money for the owners, because they had the rights to The Hobbit. They were going to revert. And so they just kind of churned this thing out just so they could say, look, we made use of the,
like, they extended the copyright essentially, or they
basically
extended,
yeah. And so this, it does like a bunch of weird stuff with the story. I mean, obviously it's way shorter than the story of The Hobbit. The dragon is not named Smaug. It's named Slag. And Bilbo, the creator wanted to tone down some of Bilbo's bachelor habits. So Bilbo gets married.
Oh,
in this to a princess from Dale.
That sounds pretty homophobic too.
I think I could sense this guy saying, "Oh, he needs to show some interest in the lady."
Yeah. Well, he's gonna Bilbo, marry a princess. I'm pretty on board with the thief and the adventure stuff, but Bilbo he's a little light in the loafers.
So this is a very recognizable cultural property. It's had it's been referenced in the Batman universe. It's been referenced in Dungeons and Dragons. Like, it's been parodied and adapted hundreds of times.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing about this
book, iconic.
Iconic.
It's crazy. It is. To think that somebody's fake story permeated other fake stories. Oh. You know how fucking crazy that is?
And not just other fake stories. It is universal. Like, it is universally recognized.
Like Alice's blue dress.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of like popularized by the Disney version. Like, this shade and this style, like, you could see the dress hanging on the rack and you would know, oh, that's Alice.
We can all picture it in our heads. Like, it's unmistakably Alice.
So that's what I have to say about it. It's a good book and y'all should read it.
Very cool. Through the Looking Glass. Alice in Wonderland.
Nope. It's definitely Alice.
Congratulations.
Alice in Looking Glass.
Alice and the Glass. I was going to ask, is he a drug user? He must be a drug user.
Lewis Carroll, as far as I know, he's not.
Okay.
I don't believe
he's not anymore. Not yet.
Not anymore.
That's right. Because he's dead.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't think, there may be some evidence in the nearly 100,000 letters he wrote, but
wow.
I don't believe that this is part of his mythos, which is even more crazy, right? Because we've talked about drug books on this podcast before, and the idea that
this isn't a drug book is crazy. Like, I just assumed.
Usually people who write drug books are drug users themselves. And Lewis Carroll is just like, nope, this is going to be an acid trip without the acid.
Yeah.
Joe, you lose, but only because I really would like to just hear a nice quote from Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, okay. That's fair enough.
All right.
It's a great book.
This is not a sort of very confusing new quote that you've never heard of before. This is a classic quote, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, and you're going to love it. So.
Yeah, no, give me the greatest hits. I'm ready.
But I don't want to go among mad people, Alice remarked. Oh, you can't help that, said the cat. We're all mad here. I'm mad. You're mad. How do you know I'm mad? Said Alice. You must be, said the cat, or you wouldn't have come here.